you know, historically, intergenerationally, you know, ancestrally, how were those messages internalized? And what were my ancestors eating before all this mess happened? You know, like,
right.
How were they engaging with their bodies? And how can I reclaim that, you know? And I think that's a part of the process too. And I think there's just so many layers. And, you know, as we pull back those layers, we really do begin to connect back to ourselves.
I'm Nia Patterson, and welcome to episode 5 of Body Trauma. Today we are going to be talking with Alicia McCullough. She is a millennial licensed clinical mental health therapist and national certified counselor currently residing in Greensboro, North Carolina. But before we get started, I want to put a warning that this conversation is not censored and can include potentially triggering material. We also don't censor for cursing, but we will bleep out any numbers regarding weight or exercise activity. If at any time you feel yourself triggered or profoundly upset, please stop listening and take care of you and your mental health. That's honestly what's most important. If you're new here, we listen to people tell the story of their bodies. This might include discrimination based on race, gender, size, sexuality, etc., and also the different traumas people have experienced in their body, including mental and physical health, eating disorders, body image, sexual assault, gender dysphoria, and more. I'm really excited to go speak with Alicia, so here we go. Hello everyone, I have Alicia McCullough with me today. It is so great to have you here today.
Yes, I'm excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you identify?
Yes, absolutely. So I identify as a Black woman, born and raised in the South, but I also think it's important to also talk about identities of privilege, especially when talking about body trauma or body justice. And so I do hope identities of being a cisgendered woman, also being hetero, as well as also being a thin woman, as well as being able-bodied. So I think that's important to discuss when talking about body trauma and identity.
100%. Yes, I totally agree.
Yes.
So I guess we'll just get started. What has life been like in your body?
Yeah. And so when I thought about that, I really kind of went big and then went small.
Okay.
And so I thought about just for, you know, the community. And so for the Black community, and I know, again, not viewing the Black community as a monolith, but kind of seeing us as being very diverse and having different, you know, experiences and intersectionalities. But one of the things that I noticed is that oftentimes, you know, due to racism and how it started, you know, we have been classified into levels in a way. And that starts with skin tone, you know, hair type, you know, and also the racial classifications that, you know, determine body image from the beginning. And that's, I saw that and kind of read that in Sabrina String's book, Fearing the
Yes.
Black Body. And yeah, and saw kind of how that all started. And so with that, I started to think, well, what are some of the ways that my body has been told to take up less space? Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that I've been, you know, internalized maybe some of those messages around whiteness and white supremacy, as well as how do those all intersect with some of those things such as hair texture or, you know, skin color, or even just as a Black person existing in my body in a world that views that as a weapon. And so those are just some of the things I thought about in that. In my story, one of the things that really stood out was, you know, the earliest memory I have is when I was 6 years old, my mom, you know, making me get a perm
Ooh.
In my hair, you know.
I've got some bad memories about some perms.
Yes, yes. And yeah, and so, you know, when I was 6, I remember her taking me to the salon, you know, they did this whole process where they put it in my hair, it was burning, I was saying, oh, this hurts, you know, I can't take this, and they were saying, oh, stop being sensitive.
Right, just sit
and
with it, just sit with it, it'll be fine.
Right,
it's
right,
supposed to hurt.
Right.
Ooh,
right.
Like literally, I got a perm before freshman year in college, and mm-hmm. I didn't know I was getting my hair done. So I had washed my hair and like brushed my hair, and like I literally got chemical burns on my head that were oozing.
Oh, wow.
So
yeah.
That was the last perm I ever got.
Yes, absolutely. And that too, like you said, the chemical burns that come with it, you know, I even feel like to this day, I still have some scalp concerns from those years when I was getting those perms. So just kind of reflecting back on that 6-year-old who was being told, hey, you need to change something about your body, you know, without my consent. Also being taught, just deal with it. You know, you're going through pain, you know, just deal with it. It's okay.
Right.
You know, pain is beauty.
Oh, yes. Know? Yes. Mm-hmm. And Black women supposedly can handle so much more pain.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, even through that experience, it started, you know, really teaching me, okay, well, in order for me to be acceptable, in order for me to fit in, you know, I have to be something that I'm not or change a part of my body to make it assimilate more to that, you know, stereotypical Eurocentric beauty standard. And so that was one of the first kind of experiences around, you know, my body and the trauma and really, you know, not feeling safe and discriminated against in my body.
Yes.
Was that story of getting that perm.
Because hair is definitely one way that we assimilate into a white society.
Absolutely.
For people who have not had a perm, that is the case.
Yes, absolutely. I even remember when I decided to go natural, probably I think 7 years ago now, and just that whole process of how much shame. I decided to go through the big chop, so I, you know, cut off my hair, and just the shame that came around, like stepping out with that, you know, there was the liberation of like, wow, like I finally can be free, and the shame of like, but what does that mean for me now? How do I show up in the world now? And so I remember for the first year, I would like wear protective styles to hide that, you know, and so I even think about that in regards to what is it like to exist in my body when I have to, you know, hide my hair texture.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't have like the traditional natural hair journey. I just have always like not wanted to deal with my hair. I've just wanted it to like nicely just like go back and stay back, which is how I wear my hair. But I had gotten like, I think a perm before I moved to Nebraska in seventh grade the first time. And I didn't know how to maintain that. And I didn't know how to flat iron my own hair. So what was a little cute, well, I didn't think it was cute, but my birth mother thought it was cute. What was a cute little bob that was straightened when I went to Nebraska ended up being just like this poofy triangle of hair. And like, oh my God, like that is literally my least favorite photo of me because I couldn't straighten it. So it was just like, and it was too short to put back. So I just suffered. And so ever since then, I always had my hair long enough that I could put it back in a ponytail. And that's just how I've worn my hair for like my entire life. And like, I have really good curls. I will say like, everyone's like, you have the perfect curls. Like, I know I do, but like, I don't want to take care of them. I don't want to do a 3-hour wash day on Sundays. So I just don't.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think you're hitting on a really good point too, in that, you know, feeling like when you do have black hair, you know, that it has to be quote unquote done, you know, like it has, you have to do the whole like perfect wash and go or the perfect twist out. And it's like, well, also, can I just put my hair back and that be okay?
Right.
Yeah.
I kind of went on like a miniature little, like, I'm going to try natural hair. Well, I have natural hair, but try like fancy natural hair last summer.
Yeah.
And I like learned how to like do the wash and go and like how to deep condition and how to like do a pineapple, all of those fancy words. Google them if you don't know what we're talking about. and I mean, it looked cute, but like, you know, it still wasn't perfect to me. It wasn't like what I saw other people's hair looking like, which I feel like you fall into that trap, whether your hair is natural or treated. And like I said, it just took so much time that like I just was not up to spending that amount of time. So
Absolutely.
I just perpetually look not put together. That is just my MO. And my grandmother and my aunt hate it, but like, this is where we're at.
Absolutely, you know, and like you said, it's so much, you know, it's so much time, it's so much effort. And even, you know, when we think about like stepping into professional roles or whatever, and the expectation of like what your hair should be deemed to be professional, you know, this past year in New York, they finally passed the, you know, the Crown Act, you know, and so, like, so even thinking about that and how far we still have to go with Black hair, but how much that contributes to our body story and our ability to exist. Our hair is a big piece of that.
Because you have dreads, right?
No, so I have braids in right
there
now. But I have natural hair. And so again, like, you know, there's so many styles. It, you know?
But I do like braids. I just hate the like 7 to 14 hour process.
Oh yeah.
That is
yes,
painful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's in, and you know, and a lot of times you tell yourself, you're like, I'm not going to do this again. And then you're there again
spending like $250. Like,
right.
If you're lucky, it's $250. Mm-hmm. Like, yes.
Right.
You are there. And I think, I mean, I don't like them putting the braids in, but like the worst part is taking the braids out.
Yes, absolutely.
You're like, this will take me a day. And then 3 days later, finally it's done.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And your arms are just like on fire.
Yes, yes.
After you've pushed it out for like 4 months because you don't want to do it.
Exactly. I'm there with you.
I feel you so hard on that. So hard.
So yeah, I think about that. And then, you know, one of the other things that came up for me as well, and thinking about just body trauma is puberty, you know, something that happened to me, you know, my body was rapidly changing along with hormones, you know, and all other things. And I just remember, you know, my family, you know, kind of saying things like, oh, your chest is sticking out now, or, oh, you know, you're finally getting a bud or something like that. And so it's kind of like really, that hyper awareness when you're already in a state of maybe feeling awkward or insecure, and it being pointed out, and oftentimes not in a positive way.
Exactly.
Right. I think that, I think sometimes it's in that shaming way where it's like, okay, well, if you're saying these things are wrong, then should I be hiding my body?
Right.
You know,
and I feel like so often like eating disorders come around right at that puberty mark because like your body is rapidly changing and you feel like you have to suppress it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I even thought about too, you know, even within community, I thought, you know, did anyone tell me these things? You know, did someone like come to me and say, hey, you need to do this? And the thing is, it wasn't necessarily like the active person coming and saying that. It was more the passive, you know, seeing how they were treating their body or how they were talking about their body or how they were eating. It was those subtle messages that were saying like, no, it's not okay to take up space, or, you know, no, it's not okay for your body to develop, to the point where that's where that shame started, and that, okay, well, if it's not okay, then maybe I should shrink, you know, or play small. And I think that happens in a lot of ways.
I definitely remember I was like a choir kid, and this white girl who was like one of the older girls in the group, I think we were like older than most of the other girls in our level, she came over to me one day in choir, and she was like, we've all decided that you're the most developed girl here.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, well, thank you. Because I had like boobs and no one else had boobs, so like I don't even know where this photo has ended up at this point. It's probably long gone. But in our like choir level photo, like everyone else is like a very skinny, like thin, tiny little white girl. And then there's me with like my gigantic boobs.
Yes. Those type of things that you get.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Those type of things.
And like, I don't even think like I was necessarily like ashamed of my boobs until like I realized there was something to be ashamed of.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, even a point you were saying too, I think about when you maybe are from areas where there is a lot of, you know, where you're other in a lot of ways. And so maybe there is like a classroom full of white girls who are, you know, very thin or whatever. Then you start to say, okay, well, if there's something wrong with me being different, then what can I do to assimilate to that? And that's where, like you said, some of those eating disorders behaviors comes in. And it's like, okay, well, maybe I can try to look like them, you know, whether that's straightening my hair, whether that's shrinking my body or changing the way I talk, you know, the beginning of that code switching thing happening.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah. And then I wanted to talk about too, you know, a lot of it too, just kind of thinking about being a teenager. I know I kind of alluded to this earlier of, you know, a lot of the messages being internalized, no one really telling you, but you just seeing it. And so, you know, one of the things I remember just being a teenager is that, you know, a lot of my family kind of equating like weight and health, you know, that being kind of added together and the fear that, oh my gosh, if you're not healthy, then, you know, that means something about your worth when it doesn't, you know. And so that also being a thing of like, well, I have to be a quote healthy person. This means I have to do these things. And so that was a big piece for me. I remember just being, you know, in high school and dealing with a lot of restriction and not really taking good care of my body, you know, very neglectful of my body and my needs. And a lot of those, and a lot of that being rooted in that fear, you know. Rooted in that fear of being worthless based on those messages that were, you know, pulled together from the family.
There is this idea that, like, if you're fat, you're going to die early and you won't outlive your parents and you are not healthy. And so the solution is to go on a diet, lose weight, because that's the only way to quote unquote cure being fat. And like in reality, going on a diet is so unhealthy for your body, and it is exactly what it doesn't want. And so in this pursuit of like health, you are instead making yourself so unhealthy, but everyone sees it as you just getting so much healthier.
Yes, absolutely.
It's so
Absolutely.
problematic.
And very problematic, and no one questions it. I remember, you know, times when I was engaging in some, you know, extreme disorder eating patterns, and you know, no one said anything. Like they saw it and they didn't say anything, and almost it was praised in a way. And so, even thinking about like the morality around, oh, well, you're doing so great when you do this thing, or you know. Wonderful, you're working out and like not nourishing your body, you know, those messages that start to happen and get internalized. And like you said, are the breeding grounds for the eating disorders, which we know also lead to further, you know, outcomes that are not good for you.
Exactly. I mean, just like I didn't know all of the health effects that could go wrong from an eating disorder. Like, because I always thought, this sounds so sad, once I got to college, I thought that I chose to have an eating disorder. Like, I had made this conscious choice to like go on a diet and stop eating, even though in reality I had had an eating disorder since I was about 9. But in my mind, I was like, no, I chose it so I can choose to like not have it. And I was like, I know that like you're like really hungry and like maybe sometimes you eat a lot, but like I didn't know like all of the other health effects, like intestinal issues and like growing body hair and like all of these like heart muscle, like all of these things that like you don't immediately know the medical consequences of having an eating disorder, and you just think like, so what? I'll just be thin.
Exactly. And I think you brought up a really good point too, is, you know, not having that awareness and then getting to college, you know, where in a lot of ways things are maybe more open, maybe you have, you know, more flexibility for some people. And so a lot of times, like trying to gain back that control, whether that's like, oh, I'm going to go to the gym, you know, every day this week. Or, you know, in the cafeteria, you know, trying to still meal prep and diet and all that stuff in there brings up a lot of that, especially when you're in a culture where everybody else is doing it, you know? And so it does contribute to that in a lot of ways. And I think really drives that message of how do you, again, fit in, you know, how do you, you know, in a lot of ways, make this experience that might feel uncontrollable a little bit more controllable for you. And sometimes that is the go-to.
Like, that is so wild. I think about that now because I was actually in a sorority, which I know does not fit with anything that people think of me, but I was in a sorority in college, and there were so many other girls in my sorority who were all, like, thin. Like, even the other Black girls were thin. Like, no one really looked like me except for, like, one or two other girls. And I was always like, I have to be thin like them. They just have their shit together. Like, they're so amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, they only eat, like, this amount, and they're drinking, and, like, it's fine. And, like, noticing how many people on my Facebook have come out in the last 5 years as having an eating disorder in college and around then, and even some people that I knew in high school. And, like, these same people, like, follow me on Instagram because, like, they like my content. And it just blows my mind that these women who I was, like, fighting so hard to look like, were sick too.
Yes, absolutely. We're all, you know, drinking the water, you know, we're all swimming in that diet culture pond, you know, and unfortunately, a lot of us as women in general, you know, are told that we should, you know, going back to the taking up space, that we should take up less space, that we should shrink. And I think, you know, that goes even beyond what we put in our bodies or don't put in our bodies or how we work out or don't work out, but also, you know, how we use our voice. You know, especially as Black women, we're often silent. And so even thinking about what that looks like, you know, existing in a body where you are constantly silenced and are told, don't really use your voice. You know, I remember even in grade school, kind of being praised for being like the quiet, good Black girl, you know, and that kind of got me ahead.
And
you know?
Speak so well.
And you speak so well, right? And so really being praised for a lot of that, you know, how that shrinking and minimization, and of course that code switching, you know, as well, which I know is protective, you know?
So tell me, I guess, about an experience that you had where you were shrinking, or not necessarily shrinking, but like squeezing your body to fit this mold.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I reflect on my high school experience during a time where I was trying to fit in and I was trying to assimilate, again, being from a really small, rural, conservative town. It was already enough to be Black, you know, to be a Black woman, you know, that was already considered an outlier. And so a lot of what I was doing was saying, okay, well, how do I fit in? How do I not, you know, stand out? And again, that contributing to, you know, me shrinking myself and saying, how do I not stand out? And in that, I was engaging in a lot of behaviors such as, you know, restricting food. And so, for example, I would, you know, come home from, I would work in the mornings, come home, you know, I might have a can of fruit, and then I'd immediately go and work out. And then I'd say, all right, I'm good until dinner time, you know? That obviously was not well or taking care of my body, you know? And again, no one really said anything. And so I thought, well, if no one say anything, it's okay, you know? And I was fitting in, you know, I did have friends. And so I'm like, well, this must be working, you know? And so a lot of that, and that's when I started noticing. And again, back then I wasn't really speaking out. Like now I'm speaking out against everything and combat and all the systems.
I feel you.
But back then I wasn't. I wasn't doing that. You know, in a lot of ways I was trying to keep the peace. And, you know, again, not using my voice. And like, you know, before I wasn't natural. I was, and, you know, straightening my hair to fit in. And I understand that's not everyone's case. Some people just like doing that, but you know, that was what I was doing it for. And so there was a lot of things I had internalized from white supremacy and that I was using in order to feel safe, but it's responding out of that trauma of, you know, how do I survive in this culture? And ultimately was harming myself.
Yes. I know you said you listened to some of the earlier episodes.
Yes.
I don't know if you listened to the first episode where we talked about like specific traumas that people had sent in. But I wanted to follow up on some of the things that we talked about in that episode, where we talked about different types of trauma that people had experienced and like sent in through my Instagram poll. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that my friend and I talked about on that episode was catcalling. And I talked about it with Ayana on the second episode too.
Yeah.
And I was curious, especially by Black men, as like a Black woman, I was curious if you ever experienced that.
Absolutely, yes. One of the issues is, you know, that sexualization of young Black girls.
Yes.
That happens to us, right? That adultification. And I remember around that time where, you know, I hit puberty, I was feeling insecure and awkward and, you know, being hyper alert and that being, you know, pointed out by family, that also men were looking, you know, and they were, like, I'd be in Walmart and they just be standing around and they might, you know, start staring. Or, you know, I started to, and I'm really thinking, you know, where did I start to feel uncomfortable when I started walking past a group of men? But I did, you know, something was telling me like, this is not safe. You know, I remember, you know, not feeling comfortable around being with even family members who were men, you know, and not because they had necessarily done anything, but because of those messages around, whether it's your mom saying, don't wear that skirt, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, you just constantly being told, just stop, like, don't show yourself and don't do too much, you know? And so those messages, and yeah, I absolutely just, you know, walking out in public, even as a teenager going to the mall and some older guys rolls down his window and says something inappropriate. And it's like, why are you talking to me? I'm right, like 13.
Right. Like, I feel like men have nothing better to do. Like, you were saying that and I was like, they do just like stand around. Like, don't they have anything else to do?
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Literally standing around. And it's uncomfortable because it's not just, you know, it's the standing around, but it's the way that you're being looked at. You're being sized up. You're being looked at as, you know, like you're being taken advantage of, and they haven't maybe even touched you or anything like that or said anything, but it's the look of what they're imagining, and you know that.
Right, and you're hoping that the worst that happens is that they just leer at you and that, like, you don't get, like, grabbed or something.
Yeah, yeah. And I can say that even, you know, exists until today, you know, to the point where I don't like walking out, you know, by myself. We know nowadays that nighttime doesn't excuse any behavior, but definitely not at night.
Definitely.
I really don't, you know. And so even thinking about how restricted it is just being a woman and navigating the world, like you said, when a lot of times men are sexualizing young girls as well as women, and oftentimes, you know, wanting to do harm in some of those ways.
Like, my question is always, like, what are you getting out of it? Because like I'm not going, well, I guess a majority of women are not going to turn around and be like, oh my God, you just hit on me. Let's go have like an amazing life together and like go have sex and like, this is going to be great. You're not going to get that reaction. Mm-hmm. So like, what are you going for? Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't understand what the point is.
Yeah. And even when you were saying that, it kind of just, it just made me think, I think it's, you know, that almost that ownership over your body, right?
Right.
Like because it's not only, like you said, like, it's not only like, what are you thinking and what is your intention and, you know, where are you going with this? But I know there was a case a couple years back where, you know, there was a girl at a music festival and a guy had grabbed her and she turned around and basically advocated for herself and said, you know, don't do that. And she unfortunately was killed, you know?
Yes.
Right. And so that, like, when is it safe? You know, if I can't advocate for myself, if then I walk past you and now I'm being called all types of names because I ignored you. And then if I interact with you, then you're thinking I want something with you, you know? So what is the most appropriate way? You know,
exactly. I think
that's being a woman navigating.
There's like no safe way to like get out of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess you talked about like how many privileged identities you have as well.
Yes.
And I think it's important to talk about how privilege protects us from additional trauma.
Yes.
So how have you benefited from privilege and how has that manifested in your life?
Absolutely. And so one of the frameworks that I view privilege from is intersectionality. And so me, of course, being a Black woman, yes, I do go through hardships. Yes, that, you know, I being a woman, one, you know, I experience sexism, you know, obviously the system of patriarchy and all of that. And then as a Black woman, the racism that comes along with that, you know, as a woman in the South, you know, increased harm, more, you know, more of that white supremacy comes up a lot here. You know, I was telling someone I actually, you know, commonly see Confederate flags down here. That's not anything new, right? and so those things, SES, you know, I also am first gen and SES status, you know, I'm not high SES or anything like that. So I have experienced financial hardship. And while all of those things still hold true, I still, you know, don't have to navigate the world as someone who might have a trans identity, you know, a trans woman. I don't have to identify, I don't have to navigate the world and worry about someone killing me because of the way that I present to the world, right?
Yes.
I don't have to, you know, because I'm in a smaller body, don't have to go necessarily into the medical field and have them saying like, oh, you know, I hear you coming in because your ankle hurts, but we're just going to need you to lose weight. You know, I don't necessarily have to deal with that, you know, even around being hetero, you know, I can walk out with my partner and not have to worry about someone, you know, harassing us or killing us because of, you know, us being together and loving each other, you know? And so those are some of the things that I think about. And in a lot of ways, you know, some of the things that's why I'm fighting these systems. That's why it's important for me to do the social justice work, because everyone should be able to navigate the world and feel safe. And unfortunately, because of these systems, everybody can't. And so it's important to center to people who do experience the most marginalization so that we can have a world deserved for everyone to exist in.
Definitely. So you said that you struggled with at least disordered eating. Did you struggle with an eating disorder, or, I mean, I guess it could be an undiagnosed eating disorder, but
Yeah.
I feel like we tend, because eating disorders look, well, they don't look that way, but in the media, they look like thin white women. I feel like it's much harder as a Black woman to be diagnosed with an eating disorder.
Absolutely. You know, in my work, I always tell people that don't wait for the diagnosis, right? Because oftentimes, even when it just comes to Black people being diagnosed in general, we're either misdiagnosed or we're not diagnosed at all. So we go unseen. And so I tell people, don't wait for the diagnosis. You know yourself, you are the expert at yourself, and a therapist in a room is not the expert of your experience, right? Like, you've lived in your life. And so although like our training and experience is great, if you feel like you have an eating disorder, then that's valid. That's valid enough. And so I just wanted to say, and I think that's really important. And for me, I think it was more disordered eating and the orthorexia. I'm really obsessed with that gym culture, the whole clean eating, good and bad, all of that. I think that was really driving a lot of the factors and things that I was dealing with. Even when I got to college, you know, I had a lot more access to food. And I also like to bring in the lens of access, because when I was at home, I was very limited in food. As I mentioned earlier, I come from a lower SES family. And so I didn't have a lot of options, you know, to eat intuitively, or, you know, to have a lot of, you know, food options, you know, overall. And so when I got to college, I'm like, oh, wow, like the cafeteria has so many things that I haven't had before. And, you know, free range, you know. And
yes.
So for me, I noticed that I would go into cycles of binging. And that I felt shame around that. And that's when the orthorexia kind of, oh, I got to get in the gym and I got to work out and things like that all happen. And
like,
of course,
you got to compensate for it.
Yeah. And of course that weight cycling and all of that, that comes with the whole diet culture and things like that. And so absolutely, I would definitely say that there was some disordered eating, definitely the orthorexia, that was occurring during that time.
And did you ever get any help for that? How did you overcome that?
Yeah. At the time, like you said earlier, you know, I didn't even see it as a problem. I just thought it was something that everybody was doing, or, you know, that I was doing. And I think that happens really often where, you know, I do a lot of work around intergenerational and racial trauma. And I think often we push things down, you know, historically, we haven't had a chance to process our emotions or our feelings. And so even when it comes to things like this, you know, my disordered eating was my way of coping, you know? And so it wasn't, I didn't think it was an issue. And so what helped me was, you know, when I actually, after I graduated grad school and became a therapist and started going to therapy for myself and also working in the eating disorders field, I'm like, whoa, like, textbook definition of some of the things that I've been doing is right here, as well as working with people who have went through some similar things. It started hitting home for me, and I started really looking inward and saying, this started with me too. And, you know, it looks different than the clients that I'm working with because most of them are white, and it still, you know, is valuable. And, you know, this is real. And so really affirming myself and really doing some unpacking was what was helpful, and fully saying, you know, if I'm going to get into this work, I need to be fully committed to it. That was another piece.
So when did you start going to therapy?
Yeah. So a lot of graduate programs require you to go to therapy while you're in the program. And at the time, a lot of us kind of say like, oh, that's just a requirement of therapy, you know, a requirement for the program. But I really took it serious after I graduated and said, okay, I need to really, if I'm going to be a therapist, I can't walk the walk, but not talk the talk. And so I need to get in and get some help for myself. And so that's when I really started going. And I will say it took a while because even, you know, once you decide to go on a therapy journey, you might not find the best therapist for you.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
And so that took a while to find that therapist who really fit, you know, and really understood and was really culturally competent, as they like to say. That took a while.
Definitely. So you didn't actually go to therapy until graduate school.
Yeah. Yeah. Before graduate school, you know, my idea of kind of psychology and all of that, although I studied psychology in undergrad, it was, oh, I'm just here to help people, you know, but I don't know if I had actually conceptualized, like, what is helping people actually look like, you
right.
know? I never had thought about talking to someone about my problems because I would always just talk to my friends who, you know, knew just as much of, you know, as I did at the time. And of course, there was so much stigma about mental health. It's like, oh, only certain people go there, you know? And so a lot of my journey was also destigmatizing, you know, my need for help and support. And that was a big piece of it as well.
I feel like it's definitely like shunned in the Black community to go to therapy.
Yes.
I don't know if you watch Insecure, but I watch Insecure because I love Issa Rae.
Yes.
But they definitely threw that in there. I forget which season it was, but one of these Black women was going to therapy, and one of the main characters, Molly, was just like flabbergasted that she was going to therapy, and she was like, something's wrong with her, like... Oh my gosh, like this, like, just like you are seen as like broken and weak and incapable if you go to therapy as a Black woman.
Yes, yes. I think there's a couple things that contribute to that. One, that whole message that we get from our community around, you know, what happens in the household stays in the household.
Yes.
Right? And so we start to think about, okay, well, if it happens in the household and I can't share it, then I certainly don't need to be in a therapy room telling my family business, you know?
Right.
So I think it's that. And then I think also that whole strong Black woman persona that gets put on us, that says, you know, you have to always be strong, never show emotions, don't let anyone see you sweat. You know, I think that's another piece, and, you know, that being valuable in our community. And so to seek out help would mean that I have to be vulnerable. Someone has to see me sweat. I'm not strong, you know. And so I think that's another piece, as well as just historical trauma, in that when I, you know, think about post-traumatic slave syndrome, nobody asked slaves like, hey, you know, y'all obviously went through this terrible experience. You need some help?
In the 1860s, would you like some therapy?
Right.
Would you like to come sit in my office and talk about what you've gone through? Like, oh my, that would crack me up.
Yeah.
Like, that could be like a very inappropriate meme, but I would die. Like, I would crack up so hard about it.
Yeah, literally it didn't happen, you know, and that neglect was passed on, you know, to their children and then their children, and then more and more trauma was adding on as it was just being passed down, you know, and now we're here and still doing that, although now we have a lot more liberties to actually get help, but there's still so much of that, you know, shame. I always go back to that shame and those ingrained messages that keep us from seeking out treatment. And also there's just not enough representation in the field as well as access, you know.
I just find it very interesting because I have been in therapy since kindergarten.
Yeah.
And I was originally put into therapy because supposedly, this is what my therapist told me, I wasn't sharing my feelings.
Oh, wow. And
I just find that hilarious because, like, I grew up with my Black grandmother who, of course, didn't share her feelings. So why would I be sharing my feelings?
Yes, absolutely.
And yet, apparently, it was a big enough issue to put me in therapy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It just cracks me up. And so I talked to my therapist, like, a couple years ago, and she was like, you know, if I had thought about it at the time, I would have turned around to the parents and have been like, well, where is she getting this from?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Go all the way back to childhood, right?
Exactly.
Go back to family.
Because I don't remember like specific moments of someone saying like, don't show your emotions,
right,
or maybe like, don't cry. But like, mm-hmm, for me, I was having like explosive like blow ups.
Yeah.
And like throwing tantrums and just screaming. And that I remember being like, you can't do that.
Yes.
But it wasn't like, you can't show happiness or you can't cry. It was just like, please, please just don't blow up in the middle of the supermarket.
Yes. Yes.
And yet, I guess I took that as no emotions at all, anytime, mm-hmm, anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, often just even thinking about that piece, you know, when we don't express our emotions, they get stuck in our bodies, like thinking about body trauma, right?
Yes.
And that, you know, when we can't express anxiety, it presents as panic attacks, you know, and mm-hmm, can sometimes turn into heart disease and other things, you know. When we're depressed and we don't get a chance to express that we're sad, you know, that can turn into clinical depression and have an impact and maybe even turn into suicide ideation, you know, and isolation and things like that. You know, I just think about how much of not being able to express ourselves, how that has an impact on our body and how much we carry, and overall just how that impacts our body trauma story as well.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I always wonder about people who like get like major depressive disorder and are like depressed for like 3 months and then get out of it.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm, I can't conceptualize what that must be like, because, mm-hmm, that sounds amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I would take 3 months of not being able to get out of bed and then feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
But like,
mm-hmm,
at this point, like, I'm struggling with my psychiatrist constantly asking me like, well, do you feel better? Like, is the depression,
yeah,
less? And I'm like, I honestly don't know what life without depression is like. So,
mm-hmm,
I can't tell you if it's better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that
absolutely
is a struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And then, and like you said, like, your psychiatrist kind of pushing that, like, you have to be better, you know, like,
right,
that's the goal.
Well, because I specifically this year did TMS, which is transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, honestly, I don't think it worked, which is kind of sucky because I think it costs like $9,000.
Wow.
But which is a privilege right there that I had the health insurance to even do that.
Mm-hmm.
But like, constantly they're asking you like, do you feel any different? Is anything,
yeah,
changed since the last time you were here? You're filling out like your symptom, whatever it's called, like the survey thing,
yeah,
to like see how depressed you are. And like, I don't, like, I just couldn't tell like whether or not I felt better.
Yeah.
And also, like, I've just been so depressed for so long that like, if I have like a good day or a good week, like, one,
yeah,
I'm either like, am I manic, or,
mm-hmm,
two, I'm like,
mm-hmm,
it's gonna go away next week, like,
yeah,
I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was hard as well.
I think you really brought up a big point too, in thinking about the rush to like be better. Like, that's really,
yes,
big in the medical field of like, how do we hurry up and fix this, whether it's physical or mental? It's like the easy fix and like wanting to make it happen like tomorrow, right?
Right.
And not realizing these issues like didn't just develop overnight. Like, this is years and generations and, you know, lifetimes of, you know, experiences that we're dealing with. And, you know, the whole let's just focus on the problem and fix it doesn't necessarily work, you know, especially for us. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Like, even with like antidepressants, like they take 6 to 8 weeks yes. to work. And mm-hmm. yet on week two, your psychiatrist is like, is it helping?
Mm-hmm. Right. Literally.
And you're like, maybe, yeah. I don't know.
Right. I'm still feeling the same.
I don't know. I mean, I had like an okay 5 to 6 p.m. on Thursday. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, yes.
So, I mean, yeah, there is a rush to like get you to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, I get it. Like, it's not a great place to be in when you are depressed or anxious or struggling. Like, it's never a fun place to be in. So, like, of course, you want to hurry up and get better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I totally understand that. And, like, that is not a fault at all.
At all. Right. No one wants to, you know, be in suffering. So,
no
absolutely.
One wants to sit in depression. That's not fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So do you feel like you have made peace with your body and food, I guess?
So for me, even when I think about like my name and kind of some of the things that I, I'm a proponent for, like on my Instagram, like being Black and embodied, for example,
yes.
you know, that is a lot to be Black and embodied. That's a lot. And so what I think about is that it's never really a state of arrival. That it is a continual process. It's that waking up every day and saying, okay, I'm having a bad body day and it's okay. I'm going to give myself compassion and I don't have to love everything about myself today. And that's okay. You know, I'm not going to shame that process. And so for me, it's really waking up and saying, how do I honor myself today? Maybe I need more compassion. Maybe I wake up feeling like the best thing in the world and that's great. But just taking it day by day, I think sometimes we do feel like that pressure to kind of arrive at peace or arrive at, you know, acceptance around everything. And it's like, it's a process, you know, and being Black and embodied, you know, means that I have to figure out what it's like for me to walk out my house in a Black body and how do I embody that? Or, you know, what is it like, you know, for me to navigate situations with white people, you know, am I going to code switch in this moment? Am I going to, you know, disclose something about myself, you know, those mm-hmm. are constant things. And so the constant questions and the checking. And so it's a continual process. And so for me, I feel like that I make peace depending on the day. It is a journey and it really is determining on how you wake up every day. And that's how it works for me. So if I wake up, you know, there's some days where I do feel more confident when I wake up and that's great. There's certain days where I might, you know, walk out of my house and feel safer than other days. You know, that's even a process is walking out of my house in a Black body. There are certain times when I'm talking to someone who is white and might hold a lot of privilege that, you know, I might code switch or to protect myself. And I have to think, you know, how does that show up in me being embodied? You know, and so there's a lot of different ways. And even when it comes to food, I think about, you know, there are certain days where I feel good about the food I have in my house. When I first go grocery shopping, I definitely feel like I'm, you know, enjoying the food that I have. And then when I'm coming towards the end of the month and don't have much left, you know, that doesn't really give me a lot of options to do that intuitive eating, you know. And so
yes.
I think it depends. And I think finding peace with your food, or your body is an everyday process. And I mm-hmm. never want to get to a space of arrival. I always want to be learning and unpacking and figuring out more every day.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So how do you feel that race plays a part in your life today with everything going on and just kind of the war on Blackness?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for me, it can be a lot, but I am very proud of who I am as a Black woman. I really am. I think that it's really driven my advocacy work. I think it has been the thing that's fueled my passion for wanting to engage in racial healing and exploring what racial trauma looks like. I will say that there are times where I do feel fear. You know, there are times where, you know, I don't know the solution. You know, I have a brother and a partner and a father. And I think about, you know, I can't protect them in this world, you know, and if something were to happen, it would just happen. And so there are those times when I think that way. And so for me, it's holding space for a lot of truths, you know, holding space for I can't control things, holding space for I love the work that I'm doing, holding space for the work is heavy, you know, holding space for all of that. And knowing that all of those things contribute to what it's like to show up in my body and show up in my Blackness. And I can't separate those things. And so even when I'm doing my body justice work, I don't attempt to. I do bring in race and I do bring in, you know, privilege and intersectionality, because I can't separate those things from the work that I'm doing around body justice and food justice.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
So tell me about the work you do now and how it's been shaped by your experiences and your trauma and all of that.
Yeah. And so now, well, I'll go back. And so one of the things that really, you know, I started off in the field, I was working in a college setting and really started leading some groups around eating disorders. I was mostly working with white women in the group. And so, again, getting a framework for what eating disorders work looks like in body image work, but still not seeing myself and my community represented in that work.
Yes.
And so that was challenging.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even explain how hard it is to find a Black therapist.
Yes, extremely hard. And I'll go even back to say, like, even when it comes to applying for graduate programs for therapy, a lot of the programs, one, are based off of white research, often employ white professors, often, you know, taking a huge variety of white students. And so you'll be maybe, you know, three of a class of 32, a cohort of 32, and, you know, you graduate and like that just continues, you know? And so the field is saturated with white therapists who, you know, to be quite honest, are not necessarily culturally competent, because most times we take one class in graduate school around cultural competence. If you get a PhD, you might further that. But even still, it's nothing compared to the lived reality and really doing the anti-racist and dismantling work. And so, you know, it's hard. And then a lot of the therapists that you do find that are Black have, you know, oftentimes internalized that work, you know, due to that being the training. And so a lot of what I've noticed for myself is that I've had to really decolonize the work for myself. And so that starts inward, but also, you know, fighting these systems and saying, okay, you know, I've been taught this way, but now I'm unlearning, you know? And so that's been a big piece. And it is hard to find a Black therapist who's done that, as well as, you know, is willing to really invest in your mental health and can see you and, you know, work with your concerns. And then we get into eating disorders, it gets even smaller, you know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's kind of interesting that there are so many white therapists who think that they are competent enough to discuss race with you and to challenge that and come up against that when, I mean, they've never experienced it. And just because you've never experienced it doesn't mean you can't talk about it, but they also haven't done the work to talk about it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. A lot of it is very, they won't acknowledge their privileged identities even in the room, although those dynamics are certainly showing up. I made a post last week, I think, that talked about how white saviorism shows up in the therapy room. And so even noticing that, how when those things are not addressed, they do show up in a dynamic and it does overall impact the healing and well-being of the client that we're serving. And ultimately it's doing harm, you know, if you're not unpacking and challenging those identities in the way they show up in that space.
I actually posted a story, I don't know if you saw it, this week, where it was questioning white providers about if their Black client asked them how they show up in the world for Black bodies and how they address the privilege and dynamic in that space between the client and the provider. And I got a good number of responses from white providers.
Yeah.
Only one of them actually answered my question.
Interesting.
And
interesting.
Everyone was content to say, well, I listen to the person's experience and I want to hear what their experience is. And I was like, but that's not what I asked.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think the one that upset me the most was this one woman responded and said that she listens to the person's experience, but she wants them to educate her. And I was like, but it's not their place to educate you on how to show up for Black bodies. And also, to go further, if a Black person is doing the labor to educate you, they should be compensated for that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And instead, they are paying you to educate you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. Yeah.
So that was real frustrating.
Yes, absolutely. Literally, like, that is happening. And, you know, even within the field, you know, not even just the therapy field, but even the eating disorders or haze aligned field, there's still a lot of that, you know, and it does do a disservice when we're not centering people who experience the most marginalization, and not just centering of tokenization, but centering actually listening, you know, and doing something about it.
Yeah.
And being held accountable, you know, those are things that are important.
Like, not even in terms of marginalization, but not in this case race, but yesterday and the past couple days with all of the attacks on President Trump and his body and his fatness. And a lot of fat activists were on Twitter fighting back and, like, trying to advocate for fat bodies. And it was kind of like, where are the thin people? No thin people in the trenches saying things, defending things, and yet when it is questioned what, like, whether there are thin allies, they are constantly saying, we're here, there's good people, but those same good people were not showing up in the moment when they were needed.
Absolutely.
That happens with white people as well.
Yes, absolutely. And how much exhaustion and mental fatigue does that lead to, right? When people of privilege are not using their voices, and it's always you or someone else who holds that marginalization on the front lines, you know, experiencing it, but also having to be the ones advocating for it and speaking out. Like, how much exhaustion does that do, and how much does it really help you, you know, in the field when people are not standing up, although they have the privilege to, they just feel that discomfort?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. I wanted to say too, you know, even when I was doing that work, you know, with the groups and things like that, and not really seeing us represented, you know, one of the things that I intentionally did was screen in, you know, women of color for the next semester when I was doing the group. And what I found is that, much like I expected, our concerns were very different. You know, they were so layered. And because of the structure of where I was working, there was just not, one, the training or experience or even the resources to be able to support Black women and or women of color in general. And so I think that there's a gap in the field. One, there's not a lot of research, which, you know, I don't think white research will apply for us. And I think that we need to further that. I think that even when the research is done, it will have to be done differently and not in the same ways that it historically has. And so there's so much more left to do. And I think that it needs to be done. You know, it definitely needs to be done. And so, you know, even through my experiences, leading those groups, seeing clients individually, it really just told me that I need to do more. And a part of that is using my voice and saying, okay, how can I, you know, center and create spaces for us? You know, how can I, you know, find other providers who, you know, look like me or other providers experiencing marginalization and come together and we create something, you know, we start that research and we lead these conferences. You know, how can, again, like, my clients feel seen and heard in every aspect holistically for who they are, and what they're bringing in into their eating disorders treatment, and not feel like someone's just going to look at them and, you know, praise them for losing weight or, you know, not see race as a big issue in that. Because as we talked about, race has played such a big impact in body trauma. And I think it's so important and would be neglectful not to see that.
I was just thinking how awesome it would be to have, like, a treatment center dedicated specifically to the treatment of eating disorders in women of color.
Yes.
Like, how bomb that would be.
It would be. Yes.
Like, that would be so cool.
Yeah. I hear that. You know, even I hear that from a lot of people who do go through treatment, where it's like, well, you know, the treatment program was great, was cool. You know, I got something that I needed, but I also was like the only one.
Yep, definitely. Been there.
Yeah. Yeah. I did want to just talk about the racial trauma piece in regard to, you know, thinking about how we interact with food, you know, knowing that historically that hasn't been accessible for us, you know, and that, again, going back to the book, Fearing the Black Body, that food was moralized for us. And so I think that a lot of times, and even in doing this work around eating disorders or, you know, body image work, that we really do have to unpack, okay, not only, you know, what are all the ways that I've internalized these messages and, you know, how they've harmed me, but then, you know, historically, intergenerationally, you know, ancestrally, how were those messages internalized? And what were my ancestors eating before all this mess happened? You know, like,
right,
how were they engaging with their bodies? And how can I reclaim that, you know? And I think that's a part of the process too. And I think there's just so many layers. And, you know, as we pull back those layers, we really do begin to connect back to ourselves and undo all the stuff that was never ours in the first place.
I think there's just so much culture that we have lost, which is just so upsetting, which you're wearing your National Museum of American, of African American History shirt, which I love. That I loved that museum. I wish we could have spent more time there, but I would have loved to go through the whole building. But.
Yes. I had to go twice because the first time, like, I just, one wasn't prepared for how much walking that would be. And so I only made it through like the first floor. And then I was like, I am about to pass out. So
right. Like we were coming out up from the bottom and we were just like, yeah, we're skipping that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. It was so long, but so great. But also, like you said, like just so long and so much information. So we went back for a second time and still didn't make it through everything. But I did get to see the other two floors the next time.
Wow. Yeah. That museum is amazing.
I know.
There's just so much like history that like you don't know about. Like no one teaches you about it. No one talks to you about it.
That's certainly not the American history we got growing up.
No, it's very far from it, actually.
Right.
Yeah, that was not told to us.
Right.
They were like, the slaves liked being slaves.
Right. Yeah, right. They had enjoyed a good their time. Masters.
Mm. They were dancing.
I went to a museum in Virginia, I think last summer, and it was like an old slave quarters or whatever. I don't even know how I ended up there, but was there. And that was one of the things that were in there, like, oh, you know, our house workers really enjoyed their jobs. And I'm like,
Okay.
I'm leaving.
Did they now? Were they having a good time?
Right.
Did they post the photos on Instagram?
Right. Yes.
I feel you on that one. But yeah, that's just how it's presented. And like you as like the one like black kid who's like 10 in school isn't going to be like, are you sure?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
exactly. Mm-hmm.
You just accept it. And I honestly remember in high school, I think it was like, I think we focused on the 60s. And the civil rights movement or something around there. Or it might've just been radicalization in the 60s anyways. For some reason, I just remember this one moment where my teacher, who was a very tall, very white cowboy, like turned to me and was like, and what would be the Negro perspective on that?
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I'm gonna have to get back to you on that one.
That part, I'm gonna head out.
I think someone's calling me.
Right. My God.
And I can't even, I feel like I was just too stunned to even process what my response was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't even know what I said, but I remember him asking me that.
Yeah, and you just go into this like fight, flight, or freeze. And often it's that freeze of like, did this just really happen? Like,
right.
This is not real.
Right. Like, this is obviously a TV show.
Right.
Or it's a meme.
Right.
A real life meme.
Right.
But yeah, so, American history for you.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, I ask everyone, so in the last week, can you share a high and a low?
Yeah. And so one of my highs this week was that I ended up talking to a fellow provider in the field, and it just felt good to be validated, talk to another Black woman who had been going through some similar things that I had been going through.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes you need that.
Yes.
Know? You just feel alone, and it's like, okay, I'm just going to call, and I'm just going to check in to see if I'm the only one, and then it's like, okay, I'm not the only one. We're good. Okay.
Right? Yes. Yes.
Yes. And then my low for this week is that, so I've transitioned. One of the things I did probably a month ago, but in the midst of the pandemic, was leave a toxic work environment. And so I'm now working in private practice, and so one of the things I've noticed since I've been working is that I've been having a little bit of imposter syndrome coming up around just being in a new role and having new responsibilities. And so I've really been trying to have some self-compassion with myself around transition and change and just saying, you know, you're capable, like you know this, and it's okay if you also, you know, kind of feel strange or, you know, don't feel the most confident all the time. And so I've been trying to hold space for both in that way.
So are you working like as a private practice therapist now?
Yes, I am. Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah, that would, I want to be a therapist. I just can only imagine how that would mess with me. Because like, you have to get your own clients, which means like,
yes,
they have to want to see you. And like,
yes,
as someone who's not like, Nia, you are the bomb. Like, I'm like, why would you want to see me?
Yes, that definitely comes up with that imposter syndrome. Absolutely.
Exactly. Like, imposter syndrome is rough.
Yes, it is. It really is. And again, my only thing is just that self-compassion of like, okay, like it's, you've never been here before. It's different. It's okay to feel, you know, insecure. Like, that's okay. Let's get through this, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. All right. Well, can you tell our listeners where they can find you and more information and maybe get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. And so you all can follow me on Instagram at Black and Embodied. And you can just type that in and I'll come right up on Instagram. And then I do have a link tree within my bio that has my website, which is the Holistic Black Healing Collective, that I'm using as a community and network space for Black and Brown folks seeking healing. And so that's another way that you can get in contact with me. So feel free to look me up and I'll be there.
Awesome. Okay, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. It has been amazing getting to know you and like how your life has just impacted your work.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed speaking with you and I'm looking forward to continuing and talking and checking in.
Yes. Yes. I really appreciate you supporting the podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I love this podcast.
All right.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you again to Alicia McCullough for telling us her story and for being here today. And thank you to all of you listening to the show. I hope it was an impactful part of your week. This week's episode was sponsored by all of my patrons at The Friend I Never Wanted. You can join my Patreon for as little as $1 a month and support the podcast too. The link to my Patreon is in the show notes. Also, please go ahead and subscribe to our podcast on your podcast app so you can be notified about our next episodes. If you want to tell us your thoughts about this episode and the podcast in general, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at bodytraumapod@gmail.com. And I would so greatly appreciate it if you would leave a review on iTunes. It really helps us be seen by more people. As always, I'm Nia Patterson, and this is Body Trauma. See you next time.